Welcome to Evidence Based, a new Harbinger psychology podcast. I'm your host, Cassie Stossel. On today's episode, we're talking about using acceptance and commitment therapy to reach your goals. Our guest is Dr. Daniel J. Moran, co-author of Finding Your Why and Finding Your Way. Daniel is founder of PixSlide Consulting and associate professor at Touro University. His appearances on the Oprah Winfrey Network, The Learning Channel, and Discovery focused on discussing acceptance and commitment therapy for people dealing with anxiety, depression, and substance abuse concerns. In addition, he has successfully consulted with small startup organizations and international Fortune 500 companies to ensure leaders and associates find their why and find their way. Hi, DJ. Thanks so much for joining me today.
I am happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk about how ACT can help us with reaching our goals. So I thought we'd start off. Could you just give a little primer on what ACT is?
Sure. Acceptance and commitment therapy is an evidence-based approach that's been around for way longer than people would probably assume. I think the first randomized controlled trial was done back in 1986. So it's an evidence-based approach that really aims to increase psychological flexibility for people by using a mindfulness-based approach and use and integrate behavior change strategies. So it's a powerful approach, and I've been using it for about 30 years helping people with anxiety, obsessive compulsive repertoires, depression, trauma histories. And then I moved it into something called acceptance and commitment training. And it's been shown in the evidence to be helpful for leadership, safety, innovation, and productivity. So it's a robust applied behavioral science.
So how exactly can ACT help with reaching your goals?
I think that ACT can help contribute to helping people reach their goals in several ways. We can start by whittling down to just three ways. One, ACT helps you relate to your thoughts a little bit differently. Oftentimes, the way you're thinking about the goal or about your ability to actually achieve said goal might turn into thoughts that become obstacles. I'm never going to be able to do this, or this isn't worth my time, or who am I to think that I could achieve this? And what we're doing and what we're doing with our thoughts is sometimes, well, we're becoming our own worst enemy. So ACT teaches skills for simply noticing, or what we say in ACT, diffusing from these kinds of thoughts. So you learn to distance yourself from these thoughts. So that's number one. Number two, what I think ACT can do to help people reach their goals is help folks clarify what's really important to them. What do they do in their life that gives them some kind of meaning and purpose? Because here's the thing, we're only going to be on the planet for a finite period of time. And so it's good for us, and ACT helps with this, to figure out, well, what do we want to do with this time? What do you really care about? And then when we come up with the answers to this, I mean, they're not the right or wrong answers. They're your personal answers. But when you have these answers, we can leverage that. We can leverage those values to turn into motivation to help make commitments for creating more vitality, a more purposeful and meaningful life. And I think the third thing, if we're just whittling it down to three main things that ACT can do, I think ACT helps undo. I don't know if that's the right word. What ACT helps is helps you realize that a lot of your learning on how to deal with your feelings, your sensations, your urges, your emotions, that what you've learned to do with these feelings from your subculture might not be all that helpful in the long run. You know, people sometimes get blocked by their own emotions while they're working on a goal. Sometimes you just don't feel like working on something. That's it's a valuable objective to you, but sometimes you just don't feel like it. But you can learn that you don't actually have to feel like it. You can accept that you feel a particular way and still commit. See, there it is in the name. Accept the way that you feel and still commit to doing the things that are important to you. So in ACT, you learn how to be willing to have the way you feel instead of reacting to emotions as if they needed to be gotten rid of before working on goals. So to summarize, one, relate to thoughts differently. Two, clarify what's important to you and how to make measurable steps towards that stuff. And then three, to learn to accept your emotions and not make your life about trying to get rid of certain emotions.
Yeah, I think that last piece is really powerful.
for me, like, I really enjoy writing and I'd like to write a novel, but there's so much emotional baggage that comes with, like, actually sitting down and, you know, putting fingers to keys, if you will.
Sure, Cassie, I'm with you. I mean, you know, I've written a few things with New Harbinger, and some days you just don't feel like it. But the lucky thing is I'm really motivated to do a good job for New Harbinger. And then also I really want to contribute some value to the community. And I know that ACT and the writings on ACT can help other people in a measurable, evidence-based way. So when you have that as a value, then when you have these objectives to hit, it doesn't matter if you feel like writing that particular day, you can not feel like writing in that particular day, and you can commit to doing so anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And in the beginning, you mentioned psychological flexibility. Can you talk about what that is?
Psychological flexibility, if I'm going to talk about it in the way I've published about it, psychological flexibility describes the capacity to contact the present moment while also being aware of thoughts and emotions without trying to change those private experiences or be controlled by them. And depending upon the situation, persisting in or changing behavior in the pursuit of your values and goals. So I was going to just talk about it a little bit more briefly instead of the nerdy way I sometimes talk about it. I mean, psychological flexibility is a certain degree of resilience or grit, a willingness to have the fact that things could act as obstacles, internal obstacles, your emotions, your sensations, your urges, and saying, yeah, given that, I'm psychologically flexible enough to see that that's there, observe that that stuff there, but I'm going to contact this present moment right here and right now and do something measurable because it's related to what I really want my life to be about. So I think that's what psychological flexibility is.
Yeah, and a big piece of your new book is mindful action. Can you talk about what that is and how does it utilize the ACT hexagon model?
Yeah. Well, I think that mindful action is psychological flexibility made obvious. Siri Ming and I, while writing that book, were looking at the different authors' definitions of psychological flexibility. And we took a look at, instead of just looking at this as if it were a characteristic of a person, because we're both behavior analysts, we're both board certified behavior analysts, we said, well, how are we going to know? How are we going to know if someone's psychologically flexible? What is it if it's made obvious? And so mindful action is when people are engaged in doing things that are important to them, even if they don't feel like it, and they're more focused on the present moment. So the definition in the book and the way I've been teaching it to my clients for years now is that mindful action is purposeful, present-focused, committed behavior, while maximally attending to what you choose to make important, while unhindered by your distractions. See, if we were to break it down and a little bit more briefly here, though, is like it's purposeful. It's related to what you care about in your life, related to your values, and it's present focused. The only time you can ever behave, ever, is now, right here, right now. So we teach people those kinds of skills in the mindful action plan, how to be purposeful or values-based, present-focused or contacting the present moment, and it's committed behavior. Like you are actually going to do things that we can measure. We can measure as behavioral scientists with things like rate or duration or the intensity of your behavior, and you're maximally going to attend to. It's kind of like nerd speak there. You're mostly going to be paying attention to what you care about. What do you want to have important in your life? And then, of course, because you're a human being, you're going to be distracted. That's what happens. According to some research, 47% of the day, your thoughts are about there and then instead of here and now. Cassie, I'm going to repeat that because some of your listeners probably weren't paying attention, like probably half of them. So I'm going to say it again. 47% of the day, your thoughts are about there and then instead of here and now. So we're distracted almost half the day. So what we're doing with the Mindful Action Plan is helping people figure out their values and how to be committed to doing things that are important, while also giving them the psychological skills to be less distracted, hooked by their thoughts, and pushed around by their emotions.
In your book, you also talk about a life atlas. Can you talk about what that is and how someone might get started on one?
Yeah, I really like the addition of the life atlas in the book. An atlas is a collection of maps. So what Siri and I were discussing is this life atlas is about how do you take all the different mindful action plans that you've got for your life and put them all together. A life atlas, if we're looking at it as a tool, it's essentially asking a person, what are the domains in your life that you really care about, that you would want to have a mindful action plan around? And then can we put them all together and then measure like which ones of these areas of your life are really important and which ones of these lives are parts of your life are you paying attention to and which ones are being put on the back burner right now? So the life atlas is an exercise of saying, these are all the things that I care about and I wish I was more mindful about. And I'm going to work on how do I figure out how to get where I'm going with this atlas, with these maps. I mean, essentially, if I was going to talk about like a client, they might have a mindful action plan for how they want to be as a parent, how they want to be as a partner, and how they want to take care of their own health and well-being. And the two of us could work together on these mindful action plans, which is basically rooted in an acceptance commitment therapy. But then we put it all together and say, this is the atlas. This is the life atlas. These are the things that are going to help you get where you're going, given all the different destinations and directions you have.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously the core of this work really hinges on values. And I think it can seem very like, oh, great. Like I can work toward my values and live by them. But how can someone just sort of sit down and begin to identify their values?
That's always an interesting part of working one-on-one. When I'm a psychologist or when I'm working as an executive coach or working in organizations, even finding out from a group, what are your shared values? And you know, I'm honored to be able to do this as part of my career is just asking people, what's meaningful enough for you to say, I want to keep doing this kind of stuff with my life. I want to engage and put effort into doing these kinds of actions. And one of my favorite things to ask people is the opposite of the traditional way people do this exercise. Sometimes people ask the question, what would you do if you knew you weren't going to fail? Popular motivational speaker, kind of like 20th century rah-rah kind of entrepreneurial coaching thing. But I like asking, what would you want to do if you knew you were going to fail and you're just going to do it anyway? I mean, I really like that way because even if you don't hit the objective, you made your time and your effort and your work about something that was meaningful to you. It wasn't about the outcome. And I'm really grateful to Siri for really highlighting that in the book too, because she brought that up again to me. It's, would you want to keep doing these kinds of actions with your life, even if it didn't even have the objective met? To give you a personal example, when she was talking about that related to the book, I was in the middle of marathon training and I didn't ask her for coaching on this, but I want to run a particular marathon time. And then when she was just talking about the book, she's like, would you want to do this if you didn't hit your goal? I kept saying to myself, do I really want to work this hard every day at cross training and rest and nutrition and then cranking out all these training miles if I don't hit that particular goal? And it was so endearing of her to do this, to ask that then. And it was such an epiphany. I said, yeah, like I would want to train this hard. I want to dedicate my life to my own well-being. I want to show that I can be disciplined at things. I want to show that I can make commitments and accept that waking up early and running, you know, 7 miles on a Wednesday is a pain in the neck, and just accept the aversiveness. So that's one of the ways I like to interact with my clients, is just, what would you want to do even if it would fail? And then I would turn it around and say, well, why? Why would you want to do that? Because I was able to say to Siri, even though she wasn't asking me directly, yes, I want to keep marathon training. But the question then I asked myself, because we're working together on this ACT book, is like, why? Why do I want to keep doing this even if I don't hit it? Oh, yeah, because I want to care about my own health and well-being, show that I'm committed to things. I want to allow myself to have difficult objectives put in front of me and then see what I'm going to do with them. So that's one way. Another way, because I think that's a difficult one to get to. You really have to almost know someone to ask them that particular question, those kinds of interventions right there. Another one I like to do in order to assess values is just take a look. What are you doing on a regular basis? Client, friend, patient. Like what do you regularly do? Because I've been in enough therapy rooms and enough clinics where the client will say, I don't care about anything. There's nothing that I value. There's nothing that's meaningful to me. And then I have a particular style because I'm kind of a smart ass as a therapist and a consultant. I'll say, all right, well, what'd you do today? I mean, obviously you did things today. What were you doing? And then what happens a lot of times is they'll just explain, well, I didn't do that much. I did X. Why'd you do that? Well, I did it for this reason. Well, why was that reason important? And then if you keep that kind of questioning up, eventually they'll say, I don't know. I just did it that way. And I think if you are a caring therapist and someone who understands the human condition, you could probably figure out, with some education in acceptance commitment therapy and what values are, you can kind of like back order and say, this client, this person here must care about their interpersonal relationships, their own health, recreation, having a meaningful life, even if they can't articulate it. So a lot of the times I just ask people, what do you do on a regular basis? And why do you think you keep doing it that way?
Yeah, I really love your example too, like really putting your money where your mouth is with the training. And I always say, just to go back to the writing example, like my writing group and I were like, oh, we hate writing, like we hate it, but we love having written.
Yeah. That's a beautiful phrase. Yeah.
And I used to run half marathons literally just to finish, like no other goals in mind, just to go. And I was always like, I love having had run, but I didn't like the process of getting myself to do that.
Right. Understood. And then just to double back on that, Cassie, I mean, I think if I was working with somebody, I'd say, well, why do you think that accomplishment was meaningful to you? Because obviously, you know, like while we're writing, it can be aversive. It can be a pain in the neck. But then when we've completed and we get to clap our hands and say, I did it. I met deadline, or I met my deadline extension, and then it's out there on the internet or in print. I didn't like writing, but I like having written. Why? Why was that cool? You know? Oh, well, I like to contribute, or I like to accomplish things. And then you start to like whittle away. Well, why is that stuff important? And each individual is going to come up with a different perspective on why that stuff's important to them. So we'd like to leverage those values and say, well, since you like to reduce suffering and improve quality of living on this planet, even if it's only in your own community, and that's why you write these kinds of self-help books, can you then leverage that again for book number 3? I know you don't like it. I know it's a pain in the neck. And can you realize why this is so meaningful when it's all done? can you leverage that and say that that can be the meaning in writing this now? Like, I think values dignify accepting your emotions when those emotions are uncomfortable. It dignifies it. Like, this is why I'm willing to put up with, accept, be willing to be around these kinds of aversive feelings. It's because this stuff is important to me. These are my values.
Yeah, like, this is worth it, and this is why I'm going to keep going toward the goal.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit about the difference between values and goals? Because I think those can easily get caught up in each other.
Yeah, I mean, in brief, goals can be accomplished, measurably completed, and values cannot. Because they're directions for your behavior, they're not objectives, right? So to give you an example, like in traditional football or soccer, scoring a goal can be accomplished and measurably completed. You engage in a behavior of kicking the ball and you make the goal and the fans go wild. And it's done. It's accomplished. That's a goal. But a value doesn't get completed, but it can encourage going after goals. So you can value things like sportsmanship or athleticism. These are things that you can care about. And when you meet the goal, it has been accomplished. It has been done, but you aren't done with the sportsmanship or athleticism, right? That's why it's a value. The value is it's going to remain, and it's going to maybe motivate you to go for another goal in the same game or in the next game. So values direct your behavior, encourage and, dare I say, motivate behavior. Goals are the outcomes of.
Okay, that makes sense. And when we're starting to set these goals for ourselves, in your book, you talk about both smarter and wise goals. Can you talk a little bit about what those are?
Yeah, that's, the SMART goal is ubiquitous in business literature and maybe even around a lot of behavior therapists. So a SMART goal is specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. It's all over the internet. That's a pretty traditional thing. So we want our goals in business and maybe even in therapy to be specific, define it or pinpoint it explicitly. You know what it is. It's measurable. Quantify what is actually going to be done. So this way you know it's been completed. It's achievable. There's a lot of components to whether or not it's achievable, but make sure you're going for something you can actually have some influence over. It's relevant. It has something to do with your values, and it's time bound, right? You have a deadline. So that's traditional. I always thought it would be a good idea to have smarter goals. So Siri and I added an E and an R. Smarter goals are evaluated. Once that deadline is met, it's time bound. Now we have to say, well, did you do it or not? Right? You can't just have smart goals. You have to evaluate whether you did it or not. And then it's rewarded. I know there's probably some behavior analysts listening to this going, well, we don't call them rewards. We call them reinforcers. I got it, but we really just want to be more colloquial here. So we say it's rewarded. If you evaluate this SMART goal and you met the criteria, there should be some kind of positive reinforcer for this. So those are smarter goals. And I've been very fortunate to be able to use this for companies. And even the Wounded Warrior Project has actually adopted this in their training plans for their warriors, the men and women that go and get treated for PTSD there. Their treatment plan includes things like smarter goals. And then they also included wise goals. And I'm very honored that the Wounded Warrior Project did this. They incorporated the wise goals. And wise goals might be new to folks. Smarter goals or SMART goals are probably a little old school for some folks. But wise goals are, they're about like what I'm super excited about. Or if we wanted to, we could say, because sometimes you're not super excited about some of the SMART goals you do, what I'm significantly enthralled with. And then sometimes we call them wise goals because it's what I'm sincerely engaged in, right? Wise goals essentially take SMART goals and blend in purpose to it. You know, what I'm super excited about, that's easy. The wise goal is like, oh, I have this SMART goal because of, and I'm really excited about learning how to surf, right? But sometimes you really need to set up a SMART or a smarter goal because you are in school. Now, you might not be all that excited about some of the stuff you have to learn, but you are enthralled with your own education or making an impact. So sometimes it's not exciting to read a PDF of a journal article that was published 10 years ago. You might not be excited, but you can be enthralled with it. This is related to, you know, my values. And the other one is, or what I'm sincerely engaged in. Sometimes people are in the middle of a difficult time in their marriage. You can set up some smarter goals for your relationship, but you might not be motivated because of what's going on in the relationship. So you can set up a wise goal. Not only do you set up the smarter things to do in the relationship, but also make it a wise goal, because this is what I'm sincerely engaging in. I'm not excited about doing this Gottman stuff. I'm not necessarily enthralled with doing these kinds of things, but I'm sincerely engaged in making sure that I have a strong relationship with my partner. And I think that we can be sincerely engaged in those kinds of things. So that's what SMART, smarter, and wise goals are all about.
So it's almost like the wise goal is sort of like the ultimate driver. And then you set these smarter goals to just get you to that wise point.
Yeah, I like the way you articulated that. Yes.
Did you grow up with an emotionally immature, unavailable, or selfish parent? Join Lindsay C. Gibson, author of the self-help hit Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, for a 6-week intensive online course. You'll learn essential skills to reclaim your true self, build emotional resilience, and nurture healthy relationships. Sign up to learn more at newharbinger.com/gibson-gift and receive a free excerpt bundle from Gibson's books. New Harbinger Online Courses, expert help for better mental health.
A part of this work involves situational awareness. Can you talk about what that is and how someone might develop skillful situational awareness?
I really like the term situational awareness, because here's the deal. For a very long time, I've been trying to teach people about mindfulness. And remember that what I talked about a little bit earlier, I'm interested in ACT training. So sometimes I'm using ACT for leadership and safety. So sometimes I go out to a company, an oil field, a mine, a paper mill. And then here I am, the psychologist, coming to this place where people are wearing hard hats and steel-toe boots. And I don't know what they do. I put myself through school as an electrician and a roofer. I'm not saying anything bad, but I am saying that a lot of times, if people are doing this kind of hard work, and then here comes the psychologist to help them be more productive or safer, and then I'm going to teach them how to do mindfulness exercises. A lot of times I hear things like, oh, that sounds like some hippy dippy nonsense right here. So what I've altered it to be is I just call it situational awareness. I didn't make the term up, but with enough time in industry around vets, around people who are in the military, they start talking about situational awareness, and I started to read more about it. And basically it's defined. Situational awareness is defined as the ability to engage in task demands when there are internal and external distractors. Well, that's mindfulness, right? I mean, that's kind of what it is from a very practical point of view. Now, there might be people listening who are really interested in meditation. They might be really interested in Eastern philosophy. I get it. I know that mindfulness is a lot more than what I just mentioned. I do get it. But if I have to teach my Boilermakers down in Alabama about mindfulness, if I'm going over to Cutter Steel and teaching these steel workers about mindfulness, I think they're going to be resistant. But if I just say, well, what we're going to try to improve is situational awareness. It's this way you are attending to the risk factors in this dangerous and dynamic workspace. People start paying attention. So I like the term situational awareness, because it just seems like it's subculturally absorbable for some folks who would be resistant. And how can they develop skillful situational awareness? Well, I mean, basically by doing mindfulness exercises, but, you know, taking away the gongs and the hammered dulcimer music, right? I mean, I'm sorry, this sounded a little bit irreverent there, but I think that most people who engage in mindfulness are willing to just notice that that was an irreverent comment and let it float on by. But it situational awareness is built by learning how to attend to what's going on right here and right now. So a lot of times, like at toolbox talks, or, you know, at tailgate conversations, or during the safety meetings, I will just ask folks to go ahead and do that traditional close your eyes if you're willing to. If you don't want to close your eyes, just fix your gaze on some part of the room. And what I want you to do is one single solitary behavior exclusively. Attend to your breath. Attend to your breathing. Notice your inhale and your exhale. And then I follow that by saying, and now take that skill that you just practiced, your ability to engage in one single solitary behavior exclusively, and see if you can have that generalized to when you're using the jackhammer, when you're using the carbon arc, when you're, you know, walking up and down the scaffolding. Do one single solitary behavior exclusively. Keep 3 points of contact while you're on that scaffolding.
I talk about mindfulness a lot with other authors, and sometimes mindfulness can seem like this very high idea, especially now that it's like a keyword, you know, you see mindfulness thrown around everywhere. So I really like this. I think it's very practical.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that's what we tried to do. I mean, it's just so many people who are resistant to the idea of mindfulness. And I think it's an amazing contributor to people's behavioral health and well-being. So I try to do things a little bit more, I like the phrase subculturally absorbable, right? I mean, a rose by any other name. So whether I call it situational awareness or whether I call it mindfulness, I think the ultimate outcome is the most important piece here. I don't care what we call it. I care that people get helped by it.
Absolutely. And we've talked a lot about acceptance. Obviously, that's a crucial part of this work, of this journey. Why is acceptance such a hard piece for people to do?
Yeah. So acceptance is a willingness to have what's showing up for you personally. It's actively contacting your own psychological experiences directly, fully, without trying to get rid of them, while behaving effectively. That's demonstrating acceptance there. But here's the obstacle. I think it's the biggest obstacle, and it's our cultural upbringing. I think, at least in the West, when people are brought into this world, they're now in a situation where people are expecting that folks will control their emotions. I mean, how many times a week does an adult hear things like, oh, what are you getting mad at me for? Don't get angry at me. Or, can't you just be happy about this? Or, there. Don't be sad. Dry your tears. Or, what are you worried about? You got nothing to worry about. Stop worrying so much. My favorite is, calm down. Would you just calm down? Does that ever work? Right? I mean, so it's not going to work. It makes it even worse. And so that's the point. The world has tried to teach us to control our emotions or to avoid our emotions, to be experientially avoidant. And it doesn't work. Like, it oftentimes exacerbates the problem. It makes it worse. If I tell someone to calm down, just calm down, they get angrier. But we've got this internal dialogue with a lot of time, with this upbringing, with this, even as little kids being taught, hey, stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. And then they have that thing. All right. So I guess I got to stop having this natural emotion that's happening to me. And so it's hard. I think it's hard for some people to do this because we've given this message for so long. I mean, we give this message to kids very early in life, and it continues all the way throughout adulthood, that you should be able to control or avoid the way you feel. And I mean, I've got this habit that anytime I hear on a podcast or an Audible, on some kind of YouTube, where someone calls it a negative emotion, I'll screenshot it because I think someday I'm going to refer back to all of these quotes of people calling them negative emotions. And I just rub my temple and I'm like, wow, it's unbelievable that this psychologist, this meditation teacher, this influencer, the Dalai Lama, keeps using this phrase, negative emotions, when that gives a message that there are positive emotions that you should be going for. We're going to have a proclivity to go for positive emotions, and we got to avoid and not accept that we have negative emotions. I think it's nonsense to call them negative emotions. I think they're natural emotions. I think it's just the way you feel. But our culture keeps reinforcing the term negative emotions, and stop crying, I'll give you something to cry about.
Yeah, I think that reminds me of, you know, when we started this conversation, you said the three ways that ACT can help. And one of them was sort of that like unlearning, undoing.
Yeah.
And that really makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's it. That you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I just really wish we could teach people to be willing to have the ancient signals from our ancestors that served them well. So much so that it got passed on genetically for eons, generations, and it's still with us now. These emotions are a gift. They're not something to be gotten rid of. And the things people do to get rid of them oftentimes just makes life worse. I don't like the way I feel, so I'm going to go to the corner bar and get hammered. I don't like the way I feel, so I'm not going to tell my partner about my emotions and the way that our interactions are leading to them, because I don't want to feel this way. I don't like feeling stressed out or irritated, so I'm not going to do any keystrokes on my book, even though it's due next week, right? What if we could just accept that we have these ancient signals, these natural emotions? And they help us survive. They help us have signals to say, there's something going on in your life and it deserves attending to, mm-hmm. not avoiding.
Yeah, it's like, you know, no negative emotions, but definitely negative coping strategies.
Oh, well, that, yeah, right. That's for sure. I like the way you just put that. Right. There are definitely negative coping strategies for sure.
Yeah. And, so as we're on our journey to reach our goals, sometimes that can get really challenging and we might lose motivation. Do you have any strategies or tips for boosting motivation?
Well, my favorite when I'm in the ACT context is just really clarifying someone's values and reminding them of them. You're only going to be on this planet for a finite period of time. You can't control all the things that are going to happen to you. But you can have an influence on how you're going to respond to them. And if you were going to respond to some of these challenges in a way that would be meaningful to you, what would it look like? And then not doing that, what does it look like then? I mean, right there is just like a no-nonsense kind of common way of just talking about it without going too deep into acceptance commitment therapy terminology. You can't control the fact that you're going to have a lot of obstacles in your life. And how do you want to deal with this particular obstacle? And what would it be like if you just laid down and said, yeah, there's an obstacle here. And you keep doing this in many iterations. It repeatedly happens like this. How would that be for life for you? And then let's pivot away from that and say, well, what would a life well-lived be like? And Siri and I talk about that and finding your why and finding your way. What is the life well-lived for you? How do you find your way? And one of them is going back to what we said in the podcast a little bit earlier. You know, what would you do if you knew you were going to fail? What do you do on a regular basis that seems to continue to motivate you to do things? So I would probably leverage both of the answers to those kinds of questions to help boost the person's motivation.
Yeah, definitely. And DJ, Can you talk a little bit? I mean, you've definitely talked about some personal experiences, but can you talk about your own personal experience with the Mindful Action Plan?
Yeah, I've used it for lots of things in my life. This is a tough one because it's fairly vulnerable here to say how I used it. There was one of the worst seasons of my life. I became a divorced empty nester who shut down a business, sold a commercial property, sold the home I lived in 15 years, and moved from a small town in Illinois to New York City area in about 3 weeks. All of that happened. All of it happened within 3 weeks. And, you know, I'd been using the Mindful Action Plan for over a decade. I was really blessed to have this. And I say that a lot. I'm blessed to have run into acceptance and commitment therapy back in 94 because it's gotten me through some stuff, man. But I remember moving to New York, and I live on the beach on Long Island now. And I remember just going through the Mindful Action Plan. I am here now, accepting the way I feel, noticing my thoughts while doing what I care about. That is exactly what the Mindful Action Plan sentence is. That's it. It's just for folks who might not have realized it yet. The Mindful Action Plan is the core of the book, Finding Your Why and Finding Your Way. And the main tool in there is the Mindful Action Plan. And it's a checklist with those six components that are completely derived from acceptance and commitment therapy. Real brief and pivoting away, just quick tangential. I am is self as context. Here now is contact in the present moment. Accepting is obviously acceptance. Noticing is diffusion. Doing is committed action. What I care about is values. We turned it into a sentence. We just turned it into one sentence. I learned from Steve Hayes the ACT question. And the ACT question, back in the 90s, I think he was teaching me this, given a distinction between you and the stuff you're struggling with and trying to change, are you willing to have that stuff fully without defense as its stuff is? Not as what your mind says it is. And are you willing to do things that take you in the direction of what's vital and meaningful at this time and in this situation? Steve basically says that that's what builds up psychological flexibility. If you can answer yes to that question. So I just remember asking that question to myself and to clients for over a decade. And then I didn't want to just work with the ACT question anymore. I just wanted to work with the ACT statement. The answer to that question. I am here now, accepting the way I feel, noticing my thoughts while doing what I care about. That's what the Mindful Action Plan is all about. And sitting on that beach and saying, you know, I am, period. Leave it there. That self is context. I exist. I used to say, I am a husband. I am a citizen of a small town. That's not what I am. That's content of my life. I just am. Here, now. Contact this present moment. Like, this is September 2019. It's not the way it was for the last 30 years. Accepting the way I feel. Feeling sad. I'm an empty nester now. I have a great relationship with my kids, but I still accept the fact that I don't see them as often. Accepting the fact that I'm angry about so much loss that happened. The mourning that's there, I accepted it. I actively contacted that psychological experience of mourning and sadness and noticing or diffusing from my thoughts. Oh my gosh, I don't know what my life is going to be about. I'll probably have nothing but failure for the rest of my life. Thank your mind for that thought, right? I mean, it's just like what the mind throws at you. So I just noticed that I had that thought as if it were a leaf on a stream floated on by while doing. And all right, doing something, committed actions. What am I going to be doing? How about marathon training again? How about building up my consulting company again? How about getting back into academia? How about writing another book for New Harbinger, you know? And then doing what I care about. That's the final part of the Mindful Action Plan. Like, what do I want my life to be about? Well, I want to make my life about rearing my children to live a full, abundant, flexible, healthy life, reducing suffering and improving quality of living for people in the world, even if it's just my own community. And having a great time. And that's the stuff that I care about. And I said, I'm just going to do that stuff. And the mindful action plan, you know, I'm just an N equals one, right? But so the mindful action plan was proven to be really effective. I'm just a single subject design here, but it was very helpful to me. And I'm so glad that I had the training in ACT to help me develop this mindful action plan, and definitely have Siri Ming be a good partner to give me perspectives on the mindful action plan that created that book.
DJ, thank you for sharing the personal story and the vulnerability. I feel like this is a good place to wrap, unless you have any final thoughts for our listeners.
I appreciate the opportunity, Cassie, to do this. I really do. After almost 30 years of using acceptance commitment therapy and dealing with all the resistance I've heard, not only from patients and clients, but from colleagues, I can say that I spent most of my career trying to simplify ACT and make it as broadly useful for folks. So I think the mindful action plan simplifies ACT. I put it as something that's very simple. And that's what finding your why and finding your way is all about. And I think that it helps people build up their psychological flexibility. And to me, and to what I've read from lots of really erudite scholars, psychological flexibility is at the core of being successful in so many areas for human beings. So it's worth the effort. So I really appreciate the opportunity to contribute to this community and really to benefit from this community. So thanks for this opportunity to talk to you, Cassie.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thanks for the book. Thanks for simplifying ACT and making it really accessible. I know I'm about to work on my mindful action plan, so I really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks again for having me.
Do you feel stuck in your life right now? You aren't alone. Whether you struggle with depression, anxiety, trauma, or simply feel unhappy or unmotivated, you may be seeking ways to find meaning or discover the inspiration you need to create a new path in life that better serves you. Mindfulness has gained popularity as a self-help solution for a variety of mental health issues, and mindfulness meditation has been touted as powerfully effective in helping people find focus and balance in order to complete important tasks. But if you're like many other people, you may wonder, how does one actually do mindfulness? This is an accessible step-by-step guide for putting mindfulness into action every day. You'll find an evidence-based and customizable approach that blends mindfulness, behavioral activation skills, performance management techniques, and acceptance and commitment therapy to help you identify what you deeply care about, increase your motivation, get unstuck from anxiety, depression, or trauma, reach your goals, and ultimately live a more meaningful life. You will also learn to develop personal growth skills and take committed action to create positive change. If you're ready to break free from the invisible barriers that stand between you and true happiness and satisfaction, this practical mindfulness guide will help you create your own path that leads to a more intentional and vital life. Visit our website at www.newharbinger.com and use coupon code PODCAST25 to receive 25% off your entire order. New Harbinger Publications is an independent, employee-owned publisher of books on psychology, health, spirituality, and personal growth. For 50 years, our evidence-based self-help books and pioneering workbooks have helped readers make positive changes to improve mental health and well-being. Founded by psychologists Matthew McKay and Patrick Fanning, New Harbinger is proud to be an employee-owned company. Our books reflect our core values of integrity, sustainability, compassion, and trust. Written by leaders in the field and recommended by therapists worldwide, New Harbinger books are practical, accessible, and provide real tools for real change. Earning your continuing education hours doesn't have to be a painful experience. The right course can open your mind to new possibilities, increase your confidence, and hand you powerful tools to transform your clients' lives. Praxis Continuing Education and Training teams up with some of the brightest minds in mental health to provide cutting-edge, evidence-based training for practitioners. You can learn firsthand from experts like Stephen C. Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Kirk Strozel, and many others. Find your next training at praxisCET.com. That's praxisCET.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love if you rated, reviewed, and subscribed to the show, and we hope you might share it with anyone who might benefit from the content. This podcast is not a substitute for counseling with a licensed provider.